The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa Trade Management Online. Now's the time to export goods from your docks to the rest of the world. The bravery to imagine, that's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSB. Good evening and welcome to The Money Show. We're going to talk the politics of the country this evening because the politics and our economy are inextricably intertwined. And it is absolutely critical that we understand precisely what the Constitutional Court has ordered this afternoon, that elections do happen this year, last week of October into the 1st of November. That is the order of the Constitutional Court. We know what happens when you defy that court. And if you are not registered, what on earth are you going to do in order to see whether or not you can do, what's that thing when you have to go bend over backwards and do the dance under the pole and the pole gets lowered lower and lower? Lambada? What is it? It's that thing. George is too young. He doesn't understand. We'll talk about it to Bonang Mohale this evening. At what point does business go, you know what, government, you don't respond, you don't listen, you're not interested. So why don't we just let you break yourself and then we'll let the electorate decide and then maybe we'll make friends with the future government. I'm not too sure whether business is there yet. They don't want the system to break any further because, of course, fixing it would take so much longer. But my goodness me, they must feel it from time to time. We'll then talk to the entrepreneur who started a coffee shop in Cape Town and now has taken this concept and plonked it into the middle of New York City. Can it work? We'll check on our Friday file on The Money Show.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
So the Independent Electoral Commission had applied to the Constitutional Court for a postponement in elections, but the Constitutional Court says that local government elections must go ahead at some point between the 27th of October and the 1st of November this year. Phumzile van Dam, a former Member of Parliament, now styling herself as a futurist, encapsulated it nicely when she spoke about the ANC and its failure to register all of its candidates on time, saying, is the ANC broke or is it just mismanagement? It has never struggled to register candidates in the past. I find it very fascinating. The ANC's election machinery has always been tip-top. Distraction of infighting or broke? I've been mulling over this. I don't know the answer, Phumzile. I wish I could help you. And then Gwen Ngwenya, who is one of the strategists within the Democratic Alliance, suggesting that maybe the DA this time could actually win an overall majority in the city of Johannesburg because of that failure to register. We'll get the views in a moment of Bonang Mohale, the newly appointed president, elected president of Business Unity South Africa. But first, political analyst Professor Susan Boyson on the line to us from Johannesburg. This is a turn up for the book, Susan. I mean, this is an extraordinary judgment that has potentially enormous ramifications for the governing party in South Africa's municipalities, the vast majority of which it runs and controls.
Indeed, Bruce, good evening. This is probably one of the legal rulings of the year, especially because of the massive political impact that it will have. Well, also, I believe it was a good ruling for the status, the authority of the Constitutional Court. While few people would be able to argue that it's not fair, very fair to voters generally. And yes, it's just up to the Electoral Commission now within three calendar days, as this ruling says, to announce, to ascertain and announce whether it will be possible to hold a voter registration weekend. And the way I read this, slightly at this stage, at least to a non-legal mind, and still ambiguous ruling, summary of the ruling, is that the timetable may be amended in with a view to the voter registration aspect, but that the ANC will not be afforded, and that is so important, not be afforded. In my reading of this, the opportunity to correct is it's colossal. Faux-pas, mistakes, slippages, and just in short, plain in the way it has embarrassed itself in the nomination process. And that will stand, and that will have a massive knock-on effect into the election results that now we will see, the election we will see happening end of October, first day of November.
Is this in the best interests of democracy? I ask this because, whether you like it or not, the most people who do vote in elections in South Africa are historically supporters of the ANC. That majority has narrowed each and, you know, over many elections since 2008, in municipal elections and in national elections, the ANC has seen its majority contract. Yet, as far as we know, most South Africans who bother to vote do support the ANC. We are removing, or the Constitutional Court, through this judgment, is removing their right to have their candidates elected as a result of the incompetence of the party that they prefer. But still, their rights are being affected here, aren't they?
Their rights most certainly are affected, yes. And it is a very good argument to point out that so many people will not be able to vote for the candidate of their choice in an exact constituency, an exact ward where that party should have been standing. But that is something that the political party brought onto its voters, its own members and supporters. The Constitution and the Constitutional Court has a function to uphold a certain kind of constitutional and multi-party democratic order. And yes, there are no clear wins in this respect, but it is not the Constitution that it is, and the Constitutional Court, really, if one thinks it through, but the political parties that did that. And it is an indictment of that political party. Although it is not ideal, most certainly one would have wanted to see every political party bringing in, ensuring that right to each of its supporters and members, but the ANC did not do that.
Is there any room for the ANC to make that argument, to say, hold on a second, we can have an election, but if people's desire is not represented, then this election is unconstitutional, or not? Am I grabbing at straws, as the ANC might be doing, as it tries to get more voters onto the roll?
Yes, sir. I think in their hearts they would definitely be feeling that way. But then they brought it onto their own voters and supporters. They did have the opportunity. The law did give them that opportunity to bring that right to vote for the party of their choice to their followers. But they did not bring, politically, they did not bring that into the deal.
Susan Boysen, thank you. Professor Susan Boysen, political analyst this evening on The Money Show. Listening to that, Bonang Mohale, president of BUSA, who this week, newly elected president of BUSA, by the way, who this week wrote an open letter to the president, making a plaintive appeal, saying, Mr. President, please, business wants to help. Business wants to support the recovery of the economy. Please engage with us. I was under the impression, Bonang, that the relationship between business, labor and government was actually better than it had been for an awfully long time. Has it soured in recent times that we're not aware of?
No, not at all. But I think for a country, Bruce, that is in such deep trouble, where at least four absolutely catastrophic events come together at the same time, and as if that's not enough, we bring our own fifth layer with the rampant looting. You'd expect that government is reaching out to the only social partner that knows how to deliver project management, mega projects on time, on budget, and in full, Bruce. So business developed and shared its economic recovery plan and made it clear that, as always, it wants to help. Not to rebuild, but repurpose the economy past the pandemic. We understand, Bruce, that it is manifestly in our own interest to drive for change, address inequality, and help deliver an inclusive socio-economic growth, that our people don't just want charity, but business as customers, and that to create jobs in large numbers is actually creating markets of the future. Because if business doesn't succeed in this critical mission of helping to deliver a South Africa of Kholihlahla, Nelson Mandela's dreams, the South Africa that all of us have been praying for, thereby attaining nation building, social cohesion, and this elusive notion called social justice, there will simply be no business in 20 years' time, Bruce.
Bonang, here's the issue. I mean, this is talk has been going on for an awfully long time, and I think it's ebbed and flowed. And recently, COVID-19 has spurred a much greater level of cooperation between business, labor, and government than we, I think, ever imagined possible. However, business does seem to be beating its head against a door that isn't always open. We still see government take decisions, make decisions that are fundamentally anti-business, anti-progress, anti-growth decisions. At some point, do you not draw a line in the sand and say, actually, government, we don't want to support you anymore. We will wait for the next government to come along because you guys actually are not team players. We want to be team players. Do you guys really want to be team players or not?
Exactly, Bruce. And it doesn't have to be that way. Because you see, it doesn't have to be either or, but it can be both and together at the same time. It is possible to have a government that is pro-poor, pro-labor, and pro-business. Why do they find it so difficult that in order to please labor, you have to bash business? That's the part we don't understand. You see, there must be a greater use of businesses, vast and experienced resources. It is a critical partner, and because of its centrality and contribution, it must be taken much more seriously. Not called names, white-entered, nor scapegoated. Business wants to continue to be constructive, but to talk frankly and honestly, be part of the solution. And for that, it needs clear direction from government. It needs a cabinet that is aligned and pragmatic, that values meritocracy and honesty, not just beholden to some ideology. Because business, Bruce, thrives under appropriate conditions, conducive environment, and where there is regulatory certainty and policy stability. So, Bruce, we have to make hard decisions. And there are lots of significant levers that can be pulled to get the country out of the sub-investment grading, that can accelerate mass vaccine rollout, that can speed up more vaccination site accreditation, that can increase investments, that can catapult economic growth and so that business can continue to do well by doing good, Bruce.
Now, tell me here, Bonang, when it comes to what is going on with today's Constitutional Court judgment, the Constitutional Court judgment today, which effectively will exclude many ANC candidates from standing in local government elections, is democracy best served by today's Constitutional Court judgment, in your view?
Absolutely. We have the best constitution in the world, Bruce, precisely because, in fact, the constitution, not even the apex court, is the paramount, most important institution. But you see, this is a litany of embarrassing things that are being demonstrated by this ANC-led government. I mean, this afternoon we hear that the CEO of City Power comes from Eskom, and the people who are on that board say, but we didn't know. But Bruce, you know that for the last 150 years, you will never get a job at executive level without at least four checks being done. A reference check of your previous employer, a qualifications check to make sure that the qualifications you say you got and the certificates are legit, because we have found some bogus ones. But they do credit check. They do criminal record check. Out of those four, how do you miss that the past immediate occupation was actually at Eskom, and there you were fired because of impropriety and malfeasance? So honestly, it is beyond us. And the events of the 2 weeks in July, Bruce, don't stand on their own. And you can see, they were directed, of course, at the supply chain to embarrass this administration. But how do you explain to yourself, as a patriot and as conscientious business, that more than 350 lives have been lost, 150,000 jobs are at risk, 5,000 informal traders, 140 schools were vandalized or have had equipment stolen, while one school was destroyed in a fire in KZN. Within the first hour, 40,000 businesses were affected, 200,000 shopping centers were looted and damaged, 3,000 stores, 300 banks and post office outlets vandalized, Bruce, 1,480 ATMs and 120 million stolen, 161 Vika outlets, 113 communication infrastructure significantly than the mass cell mass that allow you and I to be talking with this technology that we're using today, Bruce, my dear brother.
Yep, Borang Mohale, statistics backing up his arguments very, very strongly. Business wants to collaborate with government. This far and no further, but you know, does government really want to collaborate with business? That, I suppose, is the big question. And Borang talks about the checks. I mean, yes, there should be checks. And unfortunately, what's been happening in too much of the placement of people is the wrong kind of checks, I guess, in some cases. Have been changing hands rather than the checks and balances. Somebody got only half the message. You must do checks. Okay, here's a check. Checks and balances. That's what we miss out on more often than not.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
On to the markets in a moment with Andrew Bryson. He is at Sunlum Private Wealth. I want to give you some sense as to how we are making progress on vaccinations. The magnificent Mia Milan posting a table earlier on today. It took 19 days to get from 1 to 2 million vaccines. 14 days to get to 3 million vaccines. 7 days to go from 3 to 9 million vaccines. And then we had a bit of a wobble. It took 8 days to get to 10 million. Then 5 days to 11 million. 5 days to 12 million. And then 4 days to get to 13 million vaccines. The rate of vaccine application in South Africa is improving in leaps and bounds. Young people hugely going to the queues, standing in those queues, getting vaccinated. It's huge progress coming through, which is nice to see.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
On to Andrew Bryson, who is a portfolio manager at Sunlum Private Wealth. He's a market commentator this evening. I just looked at Mediclinic's announcement today, Andrew Bryson, and Mediclinic saying it's going to procure renewable electricity through energy exchange, a deal worth £110 million, $152 million. That's lots of rand. And they are the only platform which will be able to connect business with electricity generated by independent power producers in South Africa. But this deal becomes, Mediclinic is saying, fine, we're going to go directly to the independent power producers. We're going to spend an awful lot of money getting power we can rely on. And it's just indicative of state failure, unfortunately, Andrew. Oh, let me, it would help. I'm so used to people on Zoom sort of appearing naturally by themselves that I forgot to click you on, but you're on now. Sorry, there you are.
Hi, Bruce. Look, you know, listening to Bonang, you know, you can hear some of the concerns that I think, you know, everyone has about some of the failures of governments to administer as we would expect them to. But, you know, I think it is positive that corporates are taking up the challenge of using independent power producers. I know there's a lot of activity with, I think, round five happening at the moment. And I think it's a sector that has huge opportunity. So, you know, I think it's great that that Mediclinic is putting, you know, putting some money behind it and going to help its sector grow.
Today was an interesting day. Well, yesterday was interesting because the rand suddenly went, oh, I'm exhausted. Hold on a second. Let me put my hands on my knees, take a deep breath and pause because it had 10 days of solid recovery. It was actually quite unusual and nice to see. And then paused yesterday. Then we got the US jobs numbers late this afternoon. Just 235,000 new jobs created in the United States. And that once again sent the cat amongst the dollar pigeons. And we saw weakening in the US currency. And suddenly the rand got back into its stride and started jogging stronger again.
Yeah, I mean, that payrolls number, I mean, I think it was a massive miss. I think they were looking for growth of about 725,000 jobs, and they got about 230-odd. So big miss, and markets weren't expecting that. So dollar sort of starting to weaken again after a period of pretty, pretty solid gains over the last few months. And I think, you know, it comes back to, you know, what we've been speaking about a lot is how quickly will the Fed sort of remove the punch bowl that they've got, that they've put into markets, and see interest rates start to move again in the States. So I think any shaky jobs number probably does make market participants think that they might push it out a little bit further.
Yeah, well, 14.
From what we've expected.
Yeah, 14.29 to the dollar this evening, 19.81 to the pound, 16.98 to the euro. Substantially better on the day. And look, I mean, this thing's massively volatile and depends which way the blooming wind's blowing on a day, frankly, which way the currency goes. An unusual winner on the week. And that unusual winner, I don't know if you bother keeping an eye on Steinhoff anymore, but they're making all kinds of very complicated, very legal announcements. And I think serious investors left long ago, but the share price has had an incredibly good week. And really rebounded very, very strongly earlier this week on an announcement to do with the mattress firm, and today getting support for global litigation settlements and all sorts of things. The news flow does seem to be better. It doesn't necessarily mean that this is a company worth investing in, despite the share price moves. What's your view?
Yeah, Bruce, look, I mean, it's not a company that we're following too closely anymore, but certainly, the news flow seems to have improved somewhat. I know operationally, some of the underlying companies are actually doing quite well. Unfortunately, with this litigation hanging over it, and until there's finality, it's very, very difficult to value the company. I think you probably do have some early investors getting in and saying that things are looking like they're, the outcome might be better than what we previously thought. But still, very difficult to make a call before, we get a settlement.
To the untrained eye, the Truworths results look pretty nice. Sales were up, profits are up, everything's up, 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 up. Brilliant, nice, good. Share price down 12%. What on earth scared the market on that one?
Yeah, Bruce, so, I think the earnings, although they were up, a lot of that had to do with bad debts that came in lower than expected and sort of a release of provisions there. What we did see is operating costs on the SA business. They jumped about 10% or 12% in the second half of the year, and there's a bit of pressure on margin in the SA business. So I think the market is concerned about that. And then the UK business is just still having a really tough time. A big drop in sales there, and they're still trying to right size their business. And the lockdowns, the pretty hard lockdowns in the UK, certainly didn't help, that business conditions for that office chain group over there. I think, unfortunately, it's still quite a tough period for Truworths, both in SA and in the UK.
My thanks to Andrew Bryson this evening, portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. A softer day for the JSE today, but the currency very much back in a strengthening frame of mind.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
Tonight's Friday File is all about coffee and pastries, especially maybe it's about the coffee, I'm not too sure, but I did stumble across Coco Safar in Cape Town's Cavendish Square shopping centre a couple of years ago. I met and I chatted to the co-founder, Wilhelm Liebenberg, in a part of a series of quick, upbeat little pre-Christmas interviews that year, probably 2015, 2016. Today, I see they've opened up in New York. Now, Wilhelm, it's not a sort of a place I would think I would take a new concept, a coffee bakery concept. No matter how good I am or think I am, I would think New York is the epicenter of competition, isn't it? There we go. There we go, Wilhelm. You're there. Somebody's now pushed the right button. So let me do it as if we've never been interrupted before. New York City is not a place I would take a brand new bakery and coffee concept, but you are. You're braver than most. Tell me why you've taken it there.
New York is a lightning rod on the world, and it's that one city, who knows for how many years that'll still be the case, that has just, if you're successful in New York, within months or a year, you have such global exposure that no other city can do. So fortunately, I know New York like the back of my hand, and I've invested many years in the city. I love it. I love the energy. I know the city intimately. And so I know the competition, and it reminds me of an interesting question that somebody asked Steve Jobs one day, and not that I'm comparing myself in any possible way, but it was a fascinating question that they asked him when he was bringing out his first phone and said, you've got all the competitors in the market, how are you possibly not even in a phone business? And his answer was simply, well, I know what they're all doing, and I'm bringing, then I know what I'm doing. So in a way, what's interesting about New York is that I know the players. I know them really well. You've got 8 million people on the island. You've got a few million people coming in daily. So it's a really exciting market. But I'll tell you something interesting. There is not a single brand or espresso bar in New York that has their own French quality bakery. And there's not one bakery that has coffee at a specialty level. So just, I'm not even talking patisserie, just those two basic things. So actually we know the market, and we know that we're going to do phenomenal. We've got a fantastic location right off Union Square, which is really iconic, with almost 300,000-400,000 people a day on Union Square. So prime location, we've got a fantastic team, and New York is emerging rapidly from this crisis. So it's a very positive energy, actually.
Because your website reads like, a bio for one of the Beckham kids. Conceived in New York, designed in Toronto, made in Cape Town. Hey, I don't know which of the Beckham children it is, but it's one of them. Coco Safar has been a 15-year global journey to bring you luxury all-day cafe experience and extraordinary in every way. That does demand a quick history lesson, please, in Coco Safar.
Yes, so started the first pilot stores in Montreal around 2005, then in Toronto, some pilot stores in New York. As the journey throughout this, traveling internationally and exploring and seeking what's the best trends, how business evolve in different continents and markets. And then South Africa was just a fantastic playground to set up our innovation hub and laboratory. And we make the entire store built out. It happens in Cape Town. You put it in a container, ship it to New York, ship it to London, ship it to Tokyo, anywhere else. And so it's creating jobs locally, which is really, really exciting. But people fly from internationally, come and see our brand here, and then they can compare and say, wow, how would this do in Dubai? How would this do in Paris? And it seems like people had no problem getting on a plane to come to Cape Town and see and experience the brand.
So how intimately are you involved in New York then? Because you're implying that you're licensing the rights to Coco Safar elsewhere.
So New York is completely corporate, intimately involved in every aspect of it, designing, built out, and hands-on in launching it. So which was going to be fun and a pleasure. So New York, it's a completely corporate. Internationally, we license. So we pick an ideal financial partner in a key market. But for example, we signed a phenomenal deal in the last year for the UAE with Dream Partners. In that case, we also manage. So we get our royalty, we give a turnkey solution, everything built here, shipped to them. And as of December, we're opening up a fantastic flagship in Dubai. We're also in Doha in a $5 billion development called Place Vendôme, also with a major international luxury hospitality partner. In that case, it's different. It's also a license, but they are going to manage and operate on our behalf to our standards. So, so those seem to be two models for us working fantastic. But in places like New York or London, where we're comfortable, we can obviously do the corporate locations as well.
How many stores then in total so far for this very ambitious global project of yours?
So over the years, through the evolution, we had a couple of pilot stores in, maybe seven stores in total over the evolution of pilot stores. At the moment, we have the flagship in Cape Town. We're opening a second one in the next 60 days. And then by the end of the year, we should have minimum two, possibly three open in the Middle East. And then towards the end of the year, first thing next year, we'll have our first New York store open. And from then, we're looking at opening about five smaller locations in New York. Next year, we're also looking at Paris. So we're ready.
You're taking coffee and patisserie to Paris. You have no fear whatsoever. You're not scared of anything.
Well, the turning point was about 2 years ago when I met with the head of the LVMH group, for Europe, with Bon Marché, the top luxury department store in the world. And they fell in love with the brand. And actually, funny enough, yes, you're right. I love going right in the lion's den, like New York and Paris. And fortunately, Paris is another city that I obviously adore, but also know intimately. So we have a lot of disruption in the brand, a lot of innovation, and obviously we have great respect for the art of patisserie and food and everything that happens in Paris, but we bring a lot of innovation. And because they know the markets intimately, we know what's missing and how to be respectful and still bring innovation and disruption. And I think that's what makes it exciting.
Is COVID creating an opportunity? I mean, are rentals particularly low in these markets? Are you finding opportunities that you might not have found 2 years ago?
Beyond extraordinary. In New York, we made a deal that's probably less than a third of what we would have paid before. I mean, it's absolutely unprecedented. So internationally, we've seen that if the brand is, I mean, they would not blankly give it, but the opportunities are absolutely sensational. For us, COVID was really a transformational situation. Our business has gone up a few 100% during COVID. We opened up days after the first hard lockdown, and we had lineups out the door. I think we're the only people in Cape Town serving coffee for the first 6 to 8 weeks. And the business has been thriving. On a busy weekend, we sell 1,000 to 1,500 croissants in Seapoint at a 100% destination location. So if you want to know where my confidence, and probably 20% of our clientele are French, local French in Cape Town. So if we make them happy, they come here and they feel like home. But COVID has been phenomenal for us. We've pivoted hard, and we got enormous rewards, and we're sitting full many days a week from opening to closing. So we feel very, very privileged and blessed.
Wonderful story. The optimism, the excitement of Wilhelm Liebenberg taking on the world with croissant and coffee. Coco Safar, co-founder Wilhelm Liebenberg, our Friday File.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
I was so entranced by the story, I nearly forgot to remind you that it's time for the Brutal Biz quiz. You would know that, but it's my job to remind you. 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702. I'd like to know the name of the heritage site which closed this week. It's where Nelson Mandela was rumoured to have buried a handgun somewhere near the kitchen door, X number of paces. Nobody's ever been able to find it. But this wonderful heritage site has closed its doors. What is the name of that heritage site, please? I would like an answer on 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. There will be other questions. I'll tell you when you need to know them. But that's how we play the Brutal Biz Quiz on a Friday.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, brought to you by Absa Trade Management Online, which helps you mitigate risk, increase liquidity, and trade seamlessly and securely. The bravery to imagine. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
This is The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield. Yanga in Pretoria is first through. Yanga, the heritage site that closed this week is called?
It's Lily's Leaf.
Absolutely right, Lily's Leaf. Earlier this week, Nicholas Wolpe is saying he's decided to close. He's failed to get financial assistance. He came onto The Money Show and suggested a tax increase to fund heritage sites. And Younger doesn't want to play anymore, but that's okay, Younger. Thank you for playing so far. Zabi this evening. The first South African company to make vaccines compulsory is which one?
Discovery.
Please turn your radio down. Thank you very much, Zabi. Yeah, absolutely, Discovery. Correct. Good results out of Discovery. Some capital raise. Adrian Gore says it's a no-brainer to spend another 1.5 billion rand on expanding their influence in China with Ping An Health. And then, by the way, nobody who doesn't have a vaccination can work at Discovery from January next year. The 4Africa Exchange, otherwise known as 4AX, is being relocated and renamed to what? No, it's not. Thank you, Zabi, for playing. Simon Arcadia in Pretoria. Simon?
Hi, Bruce. Yes?
The 4Africa Exchange, 4AX, is being renamed to what?
Cape Town Stock Exchange.
Cape Town, you even said Cape Town properly. Well done to you, Simon. Arcadia, very good. 4AX, two licensed and regulated stock exchanges in the country, moving from Joburg to Woodstock. And it'll rock, no doubt, in Woodstock. What cat is the latest to hot tail it out of Nigeria?
Come again, Bruce, the first part, I didn't get it clearly.
It's such a... I rewrote the question because I made it interesting and now it makes no sense whatsoever. Which cat is the latest hot-tailed out of Nigeria? What I meant to say was, which is the latest South African company to leave Nigeria?
I said it in the week.
It's a cat. Your breakfast would never be the same without them.
It's Black Cat.
Oh, Simon, I led you up the garden path. Do they make it? I think they make that. I think they make Black Cat. But they've got a bigger cat. Governor, Pretoria.
Hi, can we still respond to the question about the one that when Nelson Mandela buried the...
No! Jeez, Gandhi. Governor, keep up! Keep up, Governor. Keep up. Is he going? Okay, bye then. Bye. If you don't, you can't don't answer questions that other people have answered. That's like, then you want to get like, feel good about yourself. No, it's not the rules. Matimba, the question we're asking right now is, which is the most recent company, South African company, to leave Nigeria?
Hint?
I gave you a hint. Which cat is hot tailing it out of Nigeria?
Black Cat.
No, you've got to listen to the last person's answer. Oh, this is the brutal biz quiz, not the warm and fuzzy, cozy, cuddly biz quiz. Oh, it's such a good question. I don't think we'd have time to get a winner, which means I win. I love winning. I prefer it if you win. But I don't mind winning the biz quiz. You got a minute to come through quickly and give us an answer on the latest company to hot-tail it out of Nigeria. We'll do the best bits of the Money Show, by the way, coming up after Eyewitness News at 7. But Victor in Sunning Hill, answer, please, save me from myself.
Tiger Brand.
Tiger Brands! A cat is a tiger! Member of the cat family, absolutely right. It does make Black Cat. But it's not Black Cat high-tailing it. It is Tiger Brands entirely. One last question. Let's make it this one. Which Asian country has rejected millions of doses of Sinovac vaccine?
There
are two parts to it. Yeah. One is democratic, one is not democratic. One is hard to get into unless you are a basketball star and you're friends with Donald Trump.
South Korea.
Wrong one, Victor. I'm the winner. It's North Korea. Victor, keep it. Listen, thank you for playing, guys. Sorry we're out of time on this one. We can't keep playing the Brutal Biz Quiz this Friday night. I had fun. and I can imagine if you're sitting listening. You've got to participate, by the way. You can't just sit shouting at your radio and calling people names if they're not getting the answers right. You need to participate as well. It's the way it works. It is North Korea. Not South Korea. It's rejected 3 million doses of the Sinovac biotech vaccine, asking for them to be sent to countries that need them more. Oh, my goodness me. All right, that is it for this hour of The Money Show. Coming up in the next hour, best bits of The Money Show. That's coming up after Eyewitness News.